From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we listen to LBJ's secret White House tapes, including conversations with Jackie Kennedy shortly after JFK's assassination, with J. Edgar Hoover in an effort to thwart a homosexual scandal involving one of Johnson's aides, and with Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara about Johnson's fears that the war in Vietnam was unwinnable. We'll talk with presidential historian Michael Beschloss. He's just edited the second volume in his trilogy of LBJ's tapes. LBJ's secret White House tapes coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The White House says law enforcement officials have carried out raids today at several U.S. businesses suspected of helping to finance terrorist activities of Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda organization. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
Raids took place in Boston, Minneapolis, Seattle, and Columbus, Ohio. President Bush made the announcement at a Treasury Department facility in Virginia, where he said 62 more individuals and organizations have been added to the list of suspected terrorists whose assets will be frozen in the U.S. The president said these entities present themselves as legitimate businesses.
The entry point to these networks may be a small storefront operation, but follow the network to its center, and you discover wealthy banks and sophisticated technology, all at the service of mass murderers.
The president also urged nations around the world to freeze the assets of those on the list. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
The Postal Service is increasing the reward for information on the anthrax by mail attacks. It's now up to $1.25 million for information leading to an arrest. Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge says there have been about 10,000 anthrax hoaxes with 25 arrests. Meanwhile, in New York, investigators are tracking the travels of Kathy Nguyen to see how she got the anthrax, inhalation anthrax, that killed her. Bridgestone Firestone has agreed to pay $41 million to states in a settlement over defective tires. Each of the nation's 50 states, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, also will receive $500,000 each in the settlement. NPR's Jackie Northam reports from Chicago.
The settlement is intended to head off lawsuits that could have arisen from an investigation by state attorneys general. They were looking into whether Firestone and Ford knew of problems with tires before 6.5 million were recalled in August 2000. That the tires, usually mounted as standard equipment on Ford Explorers, are linked to at least 270 deaths and more than 700 injuries. Under the settlement, Firestone will also spend another $15 million on consumer education and lawyers' fees. The settlement comes 1 month after federal investigators found design problems that caused the tread on the tire to separate. Firestone agreed to recall another 3.5 million tires. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Chicago.
A federal appeals court today threw out the $5 billion punitive damages verdict against Exxon for the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska. The court ordered a judge to determine a lesser amount. A jury in Anchorage, Alaska, had ordered the oil giant to pay the sum to thousands of commercial fishermen, Alaska natives, property owners, and others harmed by the nation's worst oil spill. Stock prices were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 36 points to 95.54. The Nasdaq was up 2. The S&P 500 down 3. This is NPR News. A Minnesota judge has temporarily blocked any attempt to dissolve the Minnesota Twins baseball team. From Minnesota Public Radio, Michael Koo reports.
Baseball owners have agreed to buy out and shut down two of the league's 30 franchises. The two teams most frequently mentioned for elimination are the Montreal Expos and the Minnesota Twins. But the Twins' landlord says so-called contraction by Major League Baseball would violate the terms of the team's lease. Bill Lester is the executive director of the Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission in Minneapolis.
We have an enforceable contract that requires the Twins to perform the obligations of that contract, and that is to play all 81 games plus any playoff games in the Metrodome during the 2002 season.
The judge issued the restraining order until a hearing on the matter can be held. An attorney for the Twins has said the team would move to dissolve the restraining order. For NPR News, I'm Michael Koo in St. Paul.
The House today voted to create Radio Free Afghanistan. The service would beam U.S. news and entertainment programs to Afghans in their local languages. The vote for the bill was 405-2, despite objections by the State Department. The State Department says it would rather look into beefing up existing services, including Voice of America. The bill now goes to the Senate, where it currently has no sponsors. A Senate committee today voted to loosen restrictions on food exports to Cuba. The legislation would allow private financing of sales. Congress last year voted to permit food exports to Cuba, but anti-Castro lawmakers forced a ban on any government or private U.S. financing. The committee is not expected to finish work on the full bill before next year. And in Spain, suspected separatists today killed a judge in northern Basque Country. I'm Frank Stachow.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're going to listen to some of the tapes that President Lyndon Johnson secretly made of his conversations with aides and officials, including tapes that reveal his fears about the escalating war in Vietnam.
The psychological impact of the Marines are coming is going to be a bad one, and I know enough to know that. And I know that every mother is going to say, this is it. And I know that what we've done with these B-57s is just going to be Scundy School stuff compared to the Marines. And all they're going to do is be a policeman. And damned if I don't know why we can't find some kind of policeman besides a Marine. Because a Marine is a guy that's got a dagger in his hand, and it's going to put the flag up.
That's LBJ speaking to Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara in March of 1965. Ever since Watergate, American presidents have known that if they tape their conversations, it could be used against them. But in the years before that, LBJ left a remarkable behind-the-scenes history of his presidency through the conversations, mostly phone calls, that he recorded on his hidden tape system. The system was intended to give Johnson a reliable record that could be used in his daily business. All but about 4% of the tapes have been declassified. My guest is presidential historian Michael Beschloss. He's just completed the second volume in his trilogy of Johnson's edited tapes. The new book is called Reaching for Glory, and it covers the years 1964 to 65. There's also a companion CD. In addition to writing 5 previous books on the American presidents, Beschloss is a regular commentator on ABC News and The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS. He's also a trustee of the White House Historical Association. Michael Beschloss, welcome back to Fresh Air. Give us an overview of the period covered in the second volume of your book on the LBJ tapes.
Well, this is 1964 and 1965, and it was action-packed because it begins in the fall of 1964, where Lyndon Johnson was running against Barry Goldwater to become president in his own right. Then the second he's elected, he's dealing with Vietnam, civil rights, riots in the street, and also the Great Society, Medicare, and all those other programs. So you see a president dealing with all these things almost at once.
Let's start with a conversation between LBJ and Jacqueline Kennedy from December of 1963. At this point, she's still living in the executive mansion with her children. Set the context for this.
Well, this is right after John Kennedy's assassination, and Mrs. Kennedy, as you might imagine, you'll hear on the tape, is absolutely distraught. Her voice is almost otherworldly. She's not sleeping. She's, needless to say, terribly depressed. And Johnson calls her up, and on one level, Johnson is being wonderful because he almost flirts with her. He's trying to make her feel better. But at the same time, as always with Johnson, he's got a political motive, and the political motive is he felt illegitimate as president. He had suddenly come in after John Kennedy was assassinated in his whole home state, and Johnson felt that the best thing he could do for himself politically was to keep Jackie Kennedy as close to him as possible. So he keeps on calling her up, making her feel better, but also asking her, after she leaves the White House, to come back, be photographed with him. He even says that he wants John and Caroline to be his surrogate children, and she recoils from this.
Well, let's hear one of the early conversations in this series. This is from December 2nd of 1963.
Mr. President?
I just wanted you to know you were loved and by so many and so much.
Oh, Mr.
I'm
President.
One of them.
I tried. I didn't dare bother you again, but I got Kenny O'Donnell over here to give you a message. If he ever saw you, did he give it to you yet?
No.
About my letter?
No.
That was waiting for me last night?
Listen, sweetie, now, the first thing you got to learn, you got some things to learn, and one of them is that you don't bother me. You give me strength.
But I wasn't going to send you in one more letter, and I was
don't
just scared
anything.
You'd answer.
Don't send me anything. You just come over and put your arm around me. That's all you do. When you haven't got anything else to do, let's take a walk. Let's walk around the backyard and just let me tell you how much you mean to all of us and how we can carry on if you give us a little strength.
But you know what I wanted to say to you about that letter? I know how rare a letter is in a president's handwriting. Do you know that I've got more in your handwriting than I do in Jack's now?
My mother and my wife and my sisters and you females got a lot of courage that we men don't have, and so we have to rely on you and depend on you, and you got something to do. You got the president relying on you, and this is not the first thing you had. So there are not many women, you know, run around with a good many presidents. So you just bear that in mind. You got the biggest job of your life.
He ran around with two presidents. That's what they'll say about me. Okay, anytime.
Jackie Kennedy sounds to be alternating between crying and laughing in that conversation.
Yes, and you could even hear Johnson making those kiss sounds at the end. And that's what she was feeling because, you know, she was devastated. Her husband had been murdered in her arms in Dallas. And at the same time, she appreciated the fact that LBJ was trying to buck her up. And they had had a pretty good relationship when Lyndon Johnson was vice president. Johnson said, "She was the only one in the Kennedy White House who treated me like a human being."
Now, later, Johnson offers her an ambassadorship, which she declines. Why did he want to give her one? Why did she decline?
He kept on worrying that she was going to be turned against Johnson by her brother-in-law, Robert Kennedy, whom she adored. And he was absolutely right in worrying about this, because during the time that tape we just heard was made, RFK was saying to Jackie, "He's going to use you. Be careful. Don't get taken in." And so Johnson felt that the way to keep her on the reservation would be to give her a job in the administration, perhaps ambassador to Mexico or ambassador to France. Both of these she turned down.
My guest is presidential historian Michael Beschloss. He's just published the second volume of his edited transcriptions of the LBJ tapes. This volume is called Reaching for Glory, White House Tapes 1964 to 1965. Let's move on to a tape from September of 1964. This is during the period where LBJ is campaigning for the presidency against Barry Goldwater. And Goldwater has been attacking LBJ, and LBJ wants to get back at him. This is a tape with William White, a syndicated newspaper columnist. Tell us about what this tape is about.
Well, White was probably the columnist who was closest to Johnson. He was almost hagiographic about Johnson. And what Johnson is doing is he wants White to take confidential FBI information that Johnson has gotten from J. Edgar Hoover and get White to publish it. This is information that is very damaging, he thinks, to Barry Goldwater. And Johnson wants to sling this mud in a way that will not let people know that White's source is the president and the FBI.
So let's hear LBJ's 1964 conversation with William White, in which LBJ is trying to get even with Goldwater.
"Well, we got a bunch of goddamn thugs here taking us on. Now, this Goldwater's talk about morality, when if we wanted to deal in morality, what we could show on that guy. I got the record in front of me where his 89-year-old mother is drawing a tax deduction from the Goldwater stores that are owned by Associated Dry Goods for $4,900 a year, and she's too damn old to even get to the store. And when they raised hell, he agreed to reduce it to $1,200, so just let them take a tax deduction pension of $100.
Yeah.
And then they talk to me about morality.
I know that. I agree with that.
He's lined up with every one of these gambler thugs. This B.O. and the whole outfit flew him back and forth to Nevada, played with him all the time, had him in his home, all that kind of stuff. Just unthinkable. But we have brought him that out, and I hope we don't have to. But I'm tired of him talking to me about morality."
So did the information about Goldwater's mother drawing a tax deduction from the Goldwater stores ever get out? And what about the allegations of Goldwater being involved with gambler thugs? Did LBJ ever do anything with it?
It was published, but people were not terribly interested, as well they might not have been, because it wasn't really very serious or reliable information, but it shows you a lot about Johnson, because this was a time when Barry Goldwater and his running mate William Miller were saying the problem with LBJ is he may have taken over decently after the Kennedy assassination, and you may agree with his policies, but they said this is an immoral man. He doesn't have character. And Johnson worried about this because he was running at this point about 30 or 40 points ahead of Goldwater in the presidential campaign. He thought that the one thing that could bring him down would be if voters concluded that Johnson was immoral. This is why he was so desperate to sort of release stuff on Goldwater that would make Goldwater look as if he was the one who was immoral.
My guest is presidential historian Michael Beschloss. He's just edited the second volume in his trilogy of LBJ's secret White House tapes. The new book is called Reaching for Glory. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is presidential historian Michael Beschloss. He's just edited the second volume in his trilogy of LBJ's secret White House tapes. The new book is called Reaching for Glory. It covers 1964 to 65. Now, in your new collection of LBJ tapes, you also deal with some of the scandals or potential scandals, sex scandals of his administration. And one of them has to do with somebody in the administration who is gay and closeted. He's discovered, and this is, for the time, 1964, a potentially really explosive scandal. The person in question was Walter Jenkins. Who was he, and what was he alleged to have done?
Well, it's a pretty amazing part of the book. Walter Jenkins was Lyndon Johnson's closest aide in the White House, had worked for him since 1939, was a devout Catholic, had six children, but, as you say, at the same time, had another life that was secret. He was a closeted gay, and this was 1964. It was something he was very ashamed of. And the result was that in mid-October of 1964, just a few weeks before the election, Jenkins was at a party in Washington that was given for the opening of new offices for Newsweek magazine. Jenkins got drunk. He went over to the YMCA a few blocks away, which was, at that point, a well-known place where gay people could meet, and he was arrested while having sex with another man in the men's room downstairs. He was hauled into the police station, paid his fine, and amazingly enough, he went back to the White House and began working again, didn't tell anyone what had happened, and that did not become known. About a week later, there was a Republican operative who discovered this, gave the word to various newspapers, and then what happened was Lyndon Johnson himself was notified that, to his shock, his closest aide not only had been arrested, but arrested just a couple of weeks before the election. So since Johnson was worried that Goldwater could only win by pinning on him a charge of immorality, Johnson thought he was suddenly vulnerable because in those times, people might have charged that here was something someone very close to the president who might have been compromised.
So I'd like to play a conversation that LBJ had with Billy Graham on October 20th of 1964. And this is while LBJ is still reeling from this potential scandal. And there's a lot of other problems that he's having. What are the other problems?
He's trying to deal with, needless to say, beating Barry Goldwater. But the other part of it is that Jenkins, at this point, has been hospitalized and the scandal has somewhat passed, but he's worried that there will be other scandals. He's heard that the Republicans are looking for other people in his midst who either might be gay or have marital problems, or that they might be able to pin something on LBJ.
So here's LBJ and Billy Graham in a phone conversation in October 20th, 1964.
Hello, Billy. How are you, my friend?
Well, God bless you. I was telling Bill that last night I couldn't sleep, and I got on my knees and prayed for you that the Lord would just give you strength.
I told my sweet wife last night we got mental telepathy. I said if I didn't think I'd embarrass him, I'd say, please, dear Lord, I need you more than ever did in my life. I got the Russians On one side of me, taking air, the Chinese are dropping bombs around, contaminating the atmosphere, and the best man I ever knew had a stroke, and a disease hit him, and I've been tied in here with my cabinet all day, and I'd have him just make him come down and spend Sunday with me.
Well, bless your heart. I'll be glad to. I told Bill that there were two things. One was I just felt terribly impressed to tell you to slow down a little bit. I've been awfully worried about you physically.
Well.
And then the second thing, you've got this election, in my opinion, wrapped up, and you've got it wrapped up big. There's no doubt in my mind about that. You know, when Jesus dealt with people with moral problems, like dear Walter had, and I was telling Bill I wanted to send my love and sympathy to him.
Thank you.
He always dealt tender, always.
Yeah.
I know the weaknesses of men, and the Bible says we're all sinners, and we all are involved one way or another, and I just hope if you have any contact with him, you'll just give him my love and understand.
That'll mean more than anything. Come down here Saturday evening and have dinner with us, and let's have a quiet visit, and maybe have a little service Sunday morning in the White House itself.
Very interesting conversation, Billy Graham and LBJ in 1964. My guest, Michael Beschloss, is a presidential historian. His new book is Volume 2 of LBJ Tapes. It's called Reaching for Glory. Whatever did happen with the Walter Jenkins story? What kind of impact did it have on LBJ? How was it resolved?
Turned out to have no effect on the campaign because Johnson was very lucky. Within 48 hours after the revelation, a number of things happened to take the news away. There was an ouster of the British government, an ouster of the Soviet government of Nikita Khrushchev. The World Series was on, plus the Chinese fired off their first atomic weapon. The other thing was that Johnson was able to get the campaign away from this question of morality, and one way he did it, we've just heard, is by inviting Billy Graham to the White House, which he was not doing just because he wanted a little bit of moral advice. He knew that was going to be very helpful for a president who was under the attack of people saying that you're immoral to have Billy Graham, the best-known evangelist in the United States, staying in the White House and essentially giving his blessing to President Johnson.
You know, but at the same time, there's this story breaking that, you know, Walter Jenkins, a close aide to LBJ, had a homosexual relationship. There's rumors that the Republicans are going to start spreading photos of LBJ in a compromising position with a woman who wasn't his wife. What happened with that?
That was one of the worries that Johnson had. Just about 2 weeks before the election, George Reedy, his press secretary, walked in and said, there's a rumor that there's a photograph of you in a compromising position with this woman who lives in Louisiana and who does not live the proper sort of life. That's my language and not his. And Johnson was terrified that something like this might happen just before the election, an October surprise that would hand the election to Goldwater.
Did that ever happen?
It didn't happen, but what you hear and read in the book, these conversations, you know, the last few days before the election, Johnson was terrified that it would. He was on the telephone all the time to J. Edgar Hoover saying, make sure this does not happen and cause my defeat.
Well, speaking of Hoover, you include a tape with J. Edgar Hoover, and I think at this point LBJ is worried that somebody else in his cabinet is going to be exposed as gay. And there, Hoover and LBJ are having a talk about, well, how do you know if somebody's gay or not? How can you spot them? Do you want to say anything else about this conversation before we hear it?
This is Johnson. You know, he always operated at about 10 different levels. And in the one we're about to hear, the top level is he's just asking his FBI director, you know, how you spot a secret homosexual in your entourage, which in those horrible prehistoric times would have been politically damaging. But at the same time, Johnson knows privately of the rumors that Hoover himself is gay, so in a way he's sort of playing with him by saying to Hoover, tell me, how do you spot a secret homosexual?
Okay, let's hear the conversation. LBJ and J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, recorded on October 31st, 1964.
Now, we took over that investigation yesterday.
Yeah.
They said that this particular man had been under surveillance and that they were going to explode this bomb today. Now, the only person I know of who's been under surveillance by any agency has been this man over in the Navy Department.
No, I read that. What they said was that they raised the question the way he combed his hair, the way he did something else, but they They had no act of his, or he had done nothing.
It was just the suspicion that his mannerisms and so forth were such that they were suspicious.
Yeah, he worked for me for 4 or 5 years, but he wasn't even suspicious to me. But I guess you're going to have to teach me something about this stuff.
Well, you know, I often wonder what the next crisis is going to be.
I swear I can't recognize him. I don't know anything about
it. It's a thing that you just can't tell. Sometimes, just like in the case of this poor fellow Jenkins, there was no indication in any way.
No.
And I knew him pretty well, and Deloach did also, and there was no suspicion, no indication. There are some people who walk kind of funny and so forth that you might kind of think are a little bit off, or maybe queer.
What is the historic value of listening back to that, Michael Beschloss, of hearing the head of the FBI and the president of the United States speculating on how can you tell, as Hoover put it, if somebody's queer?
Well, one thing is to show how far we have come from those times, and it's a good thing, too. The other thing is it shows the way that business was oftentimes done by presidents in those days, which was, if you've got a problem, if a scandal threatens you, you call the FBI and quash it.
How far have we come since that time? Seems to me there's still...
still a lot of ways to go, but that was a time where if you appointed a gay man or a gay woman to a prominent place in your administration, that would have been politically very hard to do. Thank God things have changed since then.
Well, as recently in the Clinton administration, there were still people shot down who never got their position because they were gay.
Yes, but in the Johnson times, it wouldn't even got as far as a president making the appointment to be shot down.
Right. Getting back to Walter Jenkins, who was forced out of the LBJ administration because he was found having a gay relationship, a closeted relationship, Jenkins was replaced as special assistant to the president by Bill Moyers.
Bill Moyers, and we know him now, of course, as the television commentator, but got his start not only in the Johnson White House, but actually working for Lyndon Johnson's television station down in Austin.
Presidential historian Michael Beschloss. He's just edited the second volume in his trilogy of LBJ's Secret White House Tapes. The new book is called Reaching for Glory, and it covers the years 1964 to 65. Beschloss will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, LBJ's secret tapes of conversations in which he confided his fears about the war in Vietnam to his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara. We continue our conversation with presidential historian Michael Beschloss, who has just edited the second volume of tapes. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with presidential historian Michael Beschloss. He's just edited the second volume in a trilogy of President Lyndon Johnson's secret White House tapes, tapes of conversations with cabinet members, aides, and officials made on his hidden recording system in the Oval Office, tapes intended to give LBJ a reliable record that could be used in his daily business. The new book is called Reaching for Glory, and it covers the years 1964 to 65. There's also an audio version of the book. One of the things LBJ was known for was having a big ego, an ego that was sometimes bruised, and I think we can hear what that was like in a conversation that he had with his advisor, Edwin Weisel, after LBJ won the election against Barry Goldwater. And winning wasn't enough. He was complaining that the TV commentators were saying that he only won because people saw him as the lesser of two evils. What should we listen for in this tape?
Well, you know, Terry, when I was listening to these tapes and putting them in the book, you know, I told my wife, you know, I'm learning so much about Johnson, but I'm learning a lot about life, too. And one of the things I learned about life was that in Lyndon Johnson's case, this was a guy who had an awful lot to be thankful for, a wife who loved him, children, friends. He was president of the United States, which he had always wanted to do. But it was never enough. He was always unhappy. Rather than saying, let me enjoy the blessings I've got, he was always looking for the enemy around the door or the danger behind the curtain. And the result was that he never allowed himself to enjoy himself. And the moment that really brought it home to me was election night, 1964. He's elected by just about the largest landslide in history. And I said to myself, aha, I'll finally hear this guy actually happy. And you listen to him election night, and the first half of the night, he's complaining that Robert Kennedy, who was just elected senator from New York, had not thanked him enough in his acceptance speech. And the second half of the night, he's complaining that the TV commentators are saying this was just an anti-Goldwater election, not a pro-Johnson victory. And so in the tape that we're about to hear, you hear him complaining to this close lawyer friend of his, Ed Weisel, that we've got to do something about that.
Let's hear the tape recorded in November of 1964.
We don't have any propaganda machine, and we don't have anybody that can get out our stuff. Now, Ray Moley started this story that just voting against Goldwater, and they didn't like either one of us, and that Johnson didn't have any rapport, and he didn't have any style, and he was a buffoon, and he was full of corn, and every place I went in this campaign, I went to 49 states with Lady Bird and two girls. I was 44 myself. I had the biggest crowd that ever had before, and I got the biggest vote anybody ever got before, and I had the greatest affection that ever been demonstrated before, and the greatest loyalty, and more big businessmen, and more labor men, and more Negroes, and more Jews, and more ethnic groups, more everybody. But they say, oh, that doesn't amount to anything. So the Bobby Kennedy group, they kind of put out this stuff, and the little Kennedy folks around there had nobody, and nobody loved Johnson. And they're going to have it built up by January that I didn't get any mandate at all, that I was just the lesser of two evils, and people didn't care. And now I think that you've got to point out that Dick Daley says that he figured we'd run 750,000 in Chicago. Now we're going to run 859, and we saved the governor, and we run over a million in the state. It's the greatest candidate that he's ever seen, the greatest political candidate. And I think you got to quote him because that's what he told me a dozen times. I had twice the crowd Eisenhower ever had. Now, they wrote about Eisenhower for 8 years, but they've never written one word about us. And they've got to say something about the auditorium at Austin, Texas being filled at 2:30 in the morning just waiting to see me, the people that knew me best, and that they voted for me 6 and 8 to 1 in my home boxes, that Miller was losing, and the love and the affection they had for 30 years. Now, all they write about is not love and affection. They write, well, the lesser two evils, corn pone, Southern. Well, now let's get busy on this, Eddie, before they ruin us and make a Harding out of us. We've got to be thinking what we do about this Attorney General now. We've got to get the ablest, strongest, finest, most respectable man that we can get, because they want to make a bunch of crooks out of us.
Well, it sounds like he not only wants to win, he cares about his image.
not only cares about his image. You know, if you heard this, Terry, and you didn't know what this was, you'd think this was the talk of someone who just lost the election.
Right.
He's angry. He's upset. He's suspicious. This is just after he's gotten the biggest landslide in modern times, and he sounds miserable. And the other thing is that he keeps on saying they want to make a Harding out of us. They want to make a bunch of crooks out of us. He kept on focusing on the danger that he thought that these enemies of his, whether it was Robert Kennedy or maybe, as he came to feel, hidden enemies on his own White House staff, wanted to send him to jail, have him impeached as president. And this was a guy who was much too suspicious for his own good. And as we will hear, as time went on, it only got worse.
If you're just joining us, my guest is presidential historian Michael Beschloss, and he's just published the second volume of his LBJ Secret White House Tapes. This volume covers 1964 to 1965. It's called Reaching for Glory. Your book made news this week in the New York Times, which reported that your book reveals the story behind the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. That's the resolution that gave LBJ the authority to fight the war. This was in 1964. What did you learn about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution from the LBJ secret tapes?
Well, you know, that resolution was August of 1964, and Johnson had gone to Congress after there was, he thought at the time, an attack on an American vessel in the Gulf of Tonkin. That evening, August 64, Johnson, as he says, bombed hell out of the North Vietnamese. And then he went to Congress and said, give me a resolution that allows me to repel any further such attacks. Almost everyone in the House and Senate voted for it. That was what Johnson used as his congressional basis to fight the whole war in Vietnam. He never went back for another resolution, certainly never asked Congress for a declaration of war. And what the book shows from these tapes is that as early as a month after the Gulf of Tonkin incident took place, Johnson realized that there had never been any North Vietnamese attack on American vessel at all, so it made even the basis for the whole Vietnam War even more flimsy, but he did not tell the public.
He must have had so many burdens to bear since he was so torn up about the war. Plus, he knew that he was withholding really important information from the public. In fact, he was lying to the public.
And that's the problem because, you know, you always hear that people who have a lot of secrets have a pretty miserable life. And that's one of the stories here because Johnson was full of secrets and some secrets that we would not have found out if he hadn't made these tapes and if we weren't able to actually hear his voice and hear what he was actually saying in private.
Well, it's amazing he made the tapes. When you're having when you want to keep a secret, making a tape isn't the best way of keeping it.
Well, Johnson was perhaps the ultimate control freak, and his feeling was that if he made these tapes, he could go back with them to Texas and go through them and take out the ones that showed him as an heroic president. And my guess is that he felt that the ones that did not show him as a heroic president, he could either destroy or take out so that someone like me would not hear them years later. What he didn't bargain for was that when he hit Texas in 1969 after being president, the last thing he wanted to do was relive the tortures of Vietnam and what he had just been through. So the result was that the collection was intact and was not open until very recently.
My guest is presidential historian Michael Beschloss. He's just edited the second volume in his trilogy of LBJ's Secret White House Tapes. The new book is called Reaching for Glory. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Presidential historian Michael Beschloss is my guest. His new book is called Reaching for Glory, Lyndon Johnson's Secret White House Tapes, 1964 to 65. It's his second collection of LBJ tapes. There was a lot of speculation while LBJ was president about what would have happened in Vietnam had President Kennedy lived. Would we have gotten in deeper? Would he have pulled out sooner? And LBJ was worried that some people were saying that LBJ was blaming the war on Kennedy, and he was putting it at making it his responsibility. And LBJ was denying that he was trying to lay the blame on Kennedy. And he talked about that in a conversation with his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, in January of 1965. What should we be listening for in this tape?
Well, I put this one in the book because what it shows is that Johnson felt that Kennedy was not only John Kennedy committed to defend South Vietnam, but Johnson in January of 65 felt that if he betrayed that commitment, the person who would go after him would be the late president's brother, Robert Kennedy, because in January of 65, Robert Kennedy was not a dove, but a hawk. And so LBJ felt that if he pulled out of Vietnam, one of the big penalties he'd pay would be that RFK would make his life miserable and say, "You betrayed my brother's commitment."
Let's hear this recording between McNamara and LBJ in January of 65.
They have these little parties out at Georgetown. Bill Moyers tells me they had a party last night, and Joe Alsop called up very excited today and said that he and Kraft and all Evans and the Kennedy crowd decided that I had framed up to get to Armed Services, the Senate, to call McCone to put the Vietnam War on Kennedy's tomb, and that I had a conspiracy going on to show that it was Kennedy's immaturity and poor judgment that originally led us into this thing, that got us involved, and that his execution of it had brought havoc to the country.
Well,
now, of course, I have never laid any blame on Kennedy.
No.
Have you ever heard me blame Kennedy for anything?
Absolutely not. No, I've mentioned this to Jackie several times. I've been very impressed by your attitude on that. Well, the president was alive, as a matter of fact.
I may not have anything else in my life, but I got loyalty.
Yeah.
And I think that if any of this crowd is in your vicinity or in your associates' vicinity, I think what you ought to say to them is this, that, that I assume full responsibility for everything and don't ask anybody else to take it, including President Kennedy.
Yeah.
And during his lifetime, whatever he did, I spar. And in his death, it's my complete responsibility, and I don't shove it off on anybody else.
LBJ and Robert McNamara recorded in January of 1965. And Michael Beschloss, at this point, is Johnson starting to think that Bobby Kennedy is becoming an enemy instead of an ally?
As early as the beginning of Johnson's elected presidency after the election of 1964, Johnson figured that RFK wanted to do him in and also probably run against him for president in 1968.
And what happened to their relationship as time went by?
It went only south, Terry. Kennedy, within a few months after this tape, came out against the Vietnam War and began thinking seriously about running against Johnson in 1968. And, of course, RFK finally did in March of 1968, only a couple of weeks before LBJ pulled out.
Let's hear one more conversation between LBJ and Robert McNamara, this one recorded in June of 65, in which LBJ is confessing some of his fears about the war.
It's going to be difficult for us to, very long, prosecute effectively a war that far away from home with the divisions that we have here, and particularly the potential divisions. And that's really had me concerned for a month, and I'm very depressed about it because I see no program from either defense or state that gives me much hope of doing anything except just praying and gasping to hold on during monsoon and hope they'll quit. I don't believe they're ever going to quit, and I don't see how do we have any way of either a plan for victory militarily or diplomatically?
Well, that's as early as 65, and he thinks it's pretty hopeless. Michael Beschloss, what did you learn about how LBJ managed the war in Vietnam and what his role was in the execution of the war?
Well, the saddest revelation was that as he began the war, that he didn't feel that we could win, that there wasn't a way to win, and that he did not tell that to people. And one thing I worried about when I was working on this book and having it published just this week is that American vets are going to hear this and their families are. And what are they going to say? They're going to say, you know, our loved one or I was sent to Vietnam to fight and probably lose my life in a war that the president never felt that we had a chance to win. He was sending us into harm's way. Why did he do this? And so I think the basic thing you have to say is I think Lyndon Johnson was a good man with wonderful intentions in many ways, but one of the most basic things an American president should never do is send American human beings into harm's way while in private without telling them, thinking that they have no chance to win.
How did he manage to keep getting in deeper when he was so pessimistic about the outcome all along?
This is the Alfred Hitchcock element. He felt that he had absolutely no alternative. He felt that the only alternative open to him was to somehow try to fight this war in a way that would perhaps hold off the communists, not let the Republicans call him soft on communism. And then the other side was he felt that he shouldn't escalate the war so much that he'd risk a nuclear war with the Russians and the Chinese. Johnson said when he left the presidency, the best thing about leaving the job of being president was every single night I didn't have to worry about the fact that there might be World War III tomorrow.
How did LBJ feel about the anti-war movement and the campus protests? I mean, in some ways, he agreed with the people who were protesting the war in Vietnam. He agreed that it couldn't be won.
That's the point of the thing. He did agree, and that's the big shocker of this book, is that maybe the biggest anti-war person was LBJ, because in private he was saying the same thing as those kids were saying out in public, which is, this war is a loser. But at the same time, Johnson would not listen to what the people on the campuses were saying. In the spring of 1965, there were anti-war demonstrations of 15,000 kids or more saying, end this war. Johnson didn't listen because he convinced himself that they were totally orchestrated by communists. This was a communist conspiracy to somehow constrain him or destroy him. So you had a president who was getting more and more suspicious and depressed, more tired, more beleaguered. And rather than saying, perhaps these students are saying something I should listen to, instead he's saying, these are just the tools of communists, I'll ignore them.
There's also things in your book about the civil rights movement. And I thought we could listen to a conversation that LBJ had with George Wallace, who was then governor of Alabama. This is March 18th of 1965. And at this time, LBJ was trying to pressure George Wallace to speed black registration and desegregate the schools. And George Wallace was saying that LBJ had no authority in that area. Tell us more about what was happening at this time between LBJ and George Wallace.
Well, I was so glad to put this in the book because here's one of the great moments in history that you're so glad you have a tape of, because this was the time of the Selma to Montgomery March, and Johnson is trying to get George Wallace, the segregationist governor of Alabama, to be at least as benign as possible and not interfere, and if possible, to protect the marchers. But he didn't trust Wallace. So what you hear him doing is trying to push Wallace to give these marchers some protection, and you hear Wallace trying to protect himself politically.
Okay, this is LBJ and Governor George Wallace in March of 1965.
We got hundreds of bearded beatniks in front of my capital now. And the point I'm making is that it looks like the group coming here with the language they're using. They made a speech on the streets of our city 2 days ago, and James Foreman suggested in front of all the nuns and priests that if anybody went in a cafe and they wouldn't serve them, they'd kick the f***ing legs of the tables off. They're all making that kind of intemperate remarks and inflames people, you know. But I'm asking people to stay away from this highway, to use your superior discipline, and I'm going to do everything that I can. But now, all I want to say quite frankly is that they've been stirred up by a lot of things, and of course, I know you don't want anything to happen that looks like a revolution.
Maybe by all of us saying to them, let's have the march, let's get it over as soon as we can, let's everybody stay at home at will, and let's don't, when you talk about a revolution, that really That really upsets us all. And
well, let me say this, Mr. President. We have some revolutionaries down.
Well, I know that. I understand that.
But, and of course, if I was a revolutionary, I probably could invite a quarter of a million people to come help us. But, of course, I don't want anything like that at all.
I know.
I don't want it to get hurt. But the reason I don't want to be in the position of enemies that I'm asking for federal troops, we have ministers down here that walk up and scratch the patrolman on the hands, you know, and they turn it around. And they were preached yesterday, asked all the patrolmen what their wives were doing. We reckon some of their friends could have dates with their wives, you know, trying to provoke them, those kind of things.
I think it'd be better if you called up the guard in the service of the state, and I just approved it and gave some advisors with them rather than our doing it. And if the situation deteriorated, and if you're a highway patrolman or going back to the highways to take care of the drunk drivers and things like that, and you've got this group of that's coming and the highways moving and the tourist courts filling up, if you call up your guard, I'll put the best people we've got to work right with them, and our people here applaud the conduct of the guard the last time they had them. They think you're all right, and we'll just we'll have sitting back alerted, ready for whatever help you need these others. And I think I just say that, and I think I just ought to say it. I'm asking people in the country not to let this thing get out of hand.
Why did LBJ want Wallace to call the National Guard instead of LBJ doing it?
Because Johnson knew that if it looked as if the feds were coming in, that would hurt the civil rights movement. He wanted Wallace to do it. And, of course, Wallace, because he was against civil rights, he was throwing the hot potato back to Johnson, saying, you do it. You know, Terry, this is really Lyndon Johnson at his best in this conversation, because this was a guy who, in the pit of his stomach, what he cared most about was civil rights and poverty, wanted to help the poor. That's what he wanted to devote his presidency to instead of Vietnam. And on the civil rights side, we were all really lucky to have this Southern president in office who was the one who was bringing the civil rights revolution to America. You know, even listening to him talking to Wallace, you notice his accent gets a little bit more Southern. He speaks to Wallace in his own language. That made it a little bit easier.
My guest is presidential historian Michael Beschloss. He's just edited the second volume in his trilogy of LBJ's Secret White House Tapes. The new book is called Reaching for Glory. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Beschloss, and he's just completed the second of a projected three-volume work on the LBJ Secret White House Tapes. The new collection covers 1964 to 65. It's called Reaching for Glory. As this book is published, our president, George W. Bush, is leading a new war. And I'm sure you've been watching President Bush very carefully, and it's really amazing how, I mean, just a few months ago, he was a governor, and now now he's leading a war. Do you want to comment at all on how you think you've perceived him change in the past few weeks?
Well, you know, I think leaders don't change so much as, you know, different situations bring out different sides of them that we did not know about. And if you look back at the campaign of 2000, very rarely did you hear things mentioned like terrorism and even international relations or what any of these candidates would do if there was a crisis like this. So since George Bush had been a governor, he was untested. And you look back now at the record of him over the last month and a half, and thank God there were sides to him that many people did not see, a leader who was able to focus himself, very quickly decide how you deal with the attack of the 11th of September, and rally the country and much of the world behind that policy.
What are some of the things you're watching for as a presidential historian?
The thing I'd like to know most about, and what I wouldn't give to have some George W. Bush tapes. You know,
yeah.
Can you imagine, Terry, 11th of September, you're listening to the tapes, you know, rolling of what he was told, what he was saying on that airplane when he was flying to Barksdale, Louisiana, and off it in the Midwest and back to Washington, and how he was reacting. That would tell us so much about what kind of a president he is that we can't know in real time on the outside. What I really hope is that someday we'll get some kind of information that will reveal that to us, whether it's diaries or letters or records kept by the people around President Bush that are private now but will be released someday. And I hope that that will give us a better idea than we now have of how much he is really involved in managing this war. Is this someone who was a good chairman of the board? Is he engaged? Is he working overtime? What kind of a president he is? And in real time, there's so much spin and our sources are so inadequate, we can't really know.
And I suppose you like the fact, too, that you can use, you know, your expertise about presidents to reflect on the moment.
I think that's right, and that's one good use of history, because all of us as Americans, we all have a tendency to think that we're always inventing the wheel, that everything is something that we've never seen before. And it gives you a little bit of confidence to know that even when you go through a crisis like the one that we suffered in September and the aftermath that we're still living through right now, to look back to the earlier moments in American history where Americans have not only survived a crisis like that, but grown from it.
Michael Beschloss, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Me too. Thank you very much, Terry.
Michael Beschloss is a presidential historian. He's just edited the second volume in his trilogy of LBJ's Secret White House Tapes. The book is called Reaching for Glory, and it covers 1964 to 65. There's also an audio version of the book. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publishers of Stephen Hawking's The Universe in a Nutshell, the sequel to A Brief History of Time. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Israeli reaction to the September 11th attacks, America's war against terrorism, and the continued violence in the Middle East. We talk to the editor of the Jerusalem Report, David Horowitz. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.